I'm opening the meeting in place of co-chair Nolan, who has been delayed just briefly. And here you are. Co-chair Nolan, we have three people signed up for public testimony.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
My apologies to the committee and to the members of the audience. Thank you, Representative Nathanson. We have public testimony on items that are posted for action today. I have three people. The way we do this part of the agenda is that we allow each person to speak for about 3 minutes. And I will call a panel of all three together at the same time for efficiency. Michelle Marcus Stein, Scott Taylor, and Paul Snyder. Mr. Taylor, would you like to start?
My name is, for the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Community Corrections Directors Association. And we just wanted to offer our support for 1087 and 3638. We think that these bills together create an option that is preferable. It gives us the opportunity to continue to work with these individuals that are sitting in our counties. At any given time, we have about 14,000 folks that are on post-prison supervision out in the counties throughout the state of Oregon.
Mr. Taylor, would you pull that mic a little closer, please?
And that, is that better?
Yes, thank you.
And those 14,000 people, when they come out on post-prison supervision and those on probation when they are revoked, they frequently spend their time in the local county jail. We think that both of these bills give us the opportunity to actually invest in some treatment both prior to and upon release from institution treatment and incarceration. They allow us the... We understand that there will be more conversation around the whole process of this and the costs. And we like the idea of both the swift and certain punishment and rehabilitation sanctioning and treatment. And we think that this opportunity, the combination of these two bills, gives us a much better chance of dealing with the populations that will be impacted and taken to prison than we've had in the past, and we are therefore supportive as we help develop this compromise.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Marcus Stein?
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Co-Chair Schrader, Nolan, members of the committee. Hello, my name is Michelle Marcus-Stein-Ratcliffe, and I'm the Farmer School Manager at EcoTrust. I just want to say thank you for this opportunity to speak and also to say we're in support of House Bill 3601 that would create a farm-to-school school garden position in the Department of Education. While House Bill 3601 is related to farm-to-school and school garden concepts heard during the regular 2007 session, is distinct and was uniquely drafted to respond to changes in the regulatory landscape that had occurred since the regular session. The Oregon Department of Agriculture's new farm-to-school activities, new state nutrition standards, changing local wellness policies, and substantial private sector investment collectively create an urgent need for an immediate increase in the Oregon Department of Education's capacity. The child nutrition program staff is already working at capacity, running and monitoring the federal food program. At a crucial time when our economy is experiencing a downturn, this bill helps create new, reliable markets for Oregon food producers and processors. So in order to take advantage of existing public investment, I, along with over 40 organizations who have officially endorsed this piece of legislation that represents hundreds of thousands of Oregonians across the state, strongly urge you to fund House Bill 3601.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and appearing this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 1087 and House Bill 3638. We believe that it provides an appropriate blend of treatment and sanctions. It also recognizes the need for treatment in the context of property crimes, which are often driven because of alcohol or drug addictions or abuses. I think Mr. Taylor has very well emphasized the issues that are important to us, so I won't repeat them. We just wanted to put it on the record that we're in support of this legislation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members who also have... thank you. We have another member of the audience, Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, who wants to speak to one of the items on our agenda.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Schrader and Nolan. I'm State Senator Lori Moniz Anderson from Gresham-Troutdale, Wood Village and Fairview area. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak on Senate Bill 1074. This is the max bill, and I understand that I have submitted, and evidently you have gotten amendments to take the funding out. But I do want to bring to your attention that max has become a vital part of our state. It's a boon to our economy. It's because it allows people to travel easily between places along the max line. It's a boon for tourists, allowing them to travel with relative ease, and it also, of course, is environmentally friendly. But I want you to know that, and I'm sure you're very aware, that even though it's been a great success, we have developed some major issues that need to be addressed. And that's why Senate Bill 1074 was submitted this session, because we have had crime happening. I think you've all read about the 71-year-old Lori Lee Chakolte, who was attacked with a baseball bat, about the stabbing that occurred and the sexual assaults that occurred along the max line, and these all have been on the East County max line. And so there is an alarming growing trend of violent criminal activity. And that's so what I wanted to do is actually propose that TriMet, there's a policy piece to this, which I hope that you will pass out of committee. And I realize the funding constraints with our $190-some million shortfall that we have. And so I understand that, but I really would like you to please, if need be, pass out the policy piece, even if you can't do the funding. During the testimony before the Senate Transportation Committee, a member of the Gresham Police Force actually testified that he would not ride Max without his firearm. And so if a member of a police force sees that need, imagine the concerns of the elderly who rely on public transportation as well as people like me. And so many of us do not ride it at night anymore, although I do take Max when I go to the airport every time I'm flying out of state. But this is a real issue, and it's a real issue to people in my district. When I go to the Rockwood Neighborhood Association, I've been to the Southwest Gresham Neighborhood Association, this is the number one issue they want to talk about. The number two issue is driver's licenses, but the number one issue is safety on the max line. And that was why I had requested funding for that would have actually paid for two policemen and all of their equipment for $200,000. Gresham has the lowest tax base of any major city in the state of Oregon, and over 90% of the budget just is for police and fire. And it's very difficult also for us to pass a levy, but this was a one-time allotment, and we actually in OA are going out for a public safety levy. It'll be a 5-year levy, and because of, I think, bringing this to the forefront, I believe our citizens will definitely pass this levy, because safety is so important. So I gave you my testimony, and that's basically all I wanted to say, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for being here, and good luck with that levy. I am about to see no other person signed up to testify. I'm about to close that public testimony space, but I wanted to make sure before I do that, if anyone here didn't know that they were supposed to sign up. I'm seeing no one rushing to the table, so I will close the public testimony part of our agenda. Thank you. I'll open a work session. Colleagues, the first two items are simply formally acknowledging the reports that we received last night, so I hope we can do that very quickly. I will open a work session specifically on the purposes of accepting a report from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department on infrastructure inventory activities, and would entertain a motion to acknowledge receipt of that report. Representative Morgan makes that motion.
Exactly.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Now I will open a work session for the purpose of acknowledging receipt of a report from OECD on performance goals, funding criteria, and prioritization processes, and would entertain a motion to acknowledge receipt of that report.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Now, to the meat of our agenda, I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1066 relating to education. And I see Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This actually should be a fairly quick item for you. Senate Bill 1066 was passed on from the Senate Education Committee.
Thank you.
This bill has several pieces of legislation in it, most of them taking care of issues from last session. One issue that needs to be addressed by the Ways and Means Committee is there was $350,000 given to the Department of Education for the Talented and Gifted Education Program. Due to an oversight in the way the legislation was set up, the intent was originally to allow the department to do some contracting and potentially do the creation and administration of some regional tag centers. But the way the original language was set up, there was a percentage limit of 10% on how much the department could actually spend, which limited their ability to do those things. So the committee has fixed that language. This bill also contains some other policy issues in it. If you'd like, I could go over those. But really, all that needs to happen here is you need to take an action to pass this bill. We will add the 0.67 FTE. It's an education program specialist, too, for the Department of Education. That will be added to Senate Bill 5556 in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Any discussion or questions from committee members? Senator Gordley.
Shane, if you could briefly state for the record what the other policy issues are.
Sure. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, I would be happy to do that. What this bill also does is it charges school districts with information to prevent use of anabolic steroids and performance-enhancing supplements in health and physical education curricula. It also clarifies dates when represented and non-represented employees of school districts participate in the school district benefit plans. It extends from 1 year to 3 years the amount of time a student or others registered to complete a practicum or internship must resubmit fingerprints to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. It requires a waiver of tuition at Oregon University System Institutions and Oregon Health and Sciences University for child, spouse, and remarried surviving spouse of service members under certain circumstances. And it also repeals the statute on first aid cards required for teaching licenses.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. A question about the extends from 1 year to 3 years the amount of time a student, teacher, or others registered to complete a practicum or internship must resubmit fingerprints. Given the most recent headlines that have appeared in the paper, I don't know what the motivator was behind this, given that there are issues, and I'm just curious what the underlying rationale for doing this was.
Do we have anyone from Teacher Standards and Practices here?
And Madam Chair, I would hate to speculate. This being a policy bill, I would hate to speculate on what those issues were. I do know that this has been discussed back and forth. It was an issue of whether it was a cost and a resource issue with the department of dealing with these on that basis. And I did listen to that committee meeting. I just do not recall off the top of my head what the reason was.
Thank you. Sorry, we only do numbers. Anybody else?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Just for the record, if there's no additional money beyond what we already allocated in the 2007 session that is required for this bill, is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Co-Chair.
Good clarification. Thank you.
I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I move that we pass Senate Bill 1066A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any further discussion on the motion? Any objections?
Objections.
Motion passes. Representative Barker will carry on the House floor. Senator Walker. Thank you. I will close that work session and open the work session on Senate Bill 1074. Ms. Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1074 is in your packet, or there's a second summary in your agenda packet. Requires the Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District to perform evaluations of criminal activity occurring on or near the light rail system, of operational safety, personal safety, and security of light rail passengers, and it directs TriMet to report annually to the Legislative City Assembly until regarding the light rail safety evaluations until it's repealed in January of 2012. The original bill also includes an appropriation to the Department of Administrative Services. There is an amendment also attached to your agenda which repeals that section of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan. Discussion?
So, just for clarification, there is no fiscal impact.
If we adopt the -A3 amendment, there will be no fiscal impact.
That's correct.
And I would entertain that motion.
So moved, Madam Chair.
So, yes, before we do that, Senator Monroe.
Well, I just want to speak on the bill because I followed this issue very closely, and it's my district. The MAX line runs right through my district. I've been very impressed with the work of the new young mayor of Gresham, Shane Bemis, and Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and the police departments of both Gresham and Portland, and of Mr. Fred Hansen, the director of TriMet, in attacking what has become a serious problem of public safety and the perception of MAX not being safe. The city of Gresham has, out of its own budget, put, I believe, four regular police officers on the MAX line. They ride it regularly between downtown Gresham and about 162nd, and they have greatly reduced the amount of crime and criminal activity. I wish that we had the money to fund the additional two officers. I understand why we don't, but I just want to put on the record that this is a problem that the public officials that are directly involved are attacking vigorously, and I'd just like to give kudos to both Mayor Bemis and to Mr. Fred Hansen, the head of TriMet, for the work that they're doing, and urge an aye vote on this measure.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Schrader.
I'd like to move the -A3 amendments, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Senator Schrader moves the -A3 amendments into Senate Bill 1074. Discussion on the motion to amend. Objections? Motion carries.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Schrader.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 1074A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Schrader moves Senate Bill 1074A as amended to the floor. Discussion on that motion? I'll add my compliments to Senator Montes Anderson for her diligence on this effort. Any objections? Seeing none, carried. I suspect Senator Montes Anderson would like to carry this in the Senate.
I think so.
And the House. And the House.
We got it.
Senator. Patty Smith, did you say you wanted to carry it?
I will carry it, yeah.
Okay, thanks. close that work session. And colleagues, I'd like to slightly rearrange the order so that we can hear Senate Bill 1087 and House Bill 3638 together. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3601.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. House Bill 3601 requires the Oregon Department of Education to establish the Oregon Farm to School and School Garden Program. It authorizes the State Board of Education to adopt rules for program administration and permits the Oregon Department of Education to accept contributions for program duties. Further, it requires ODE to report to the Legislative Assembly regarding the program. Finally, it appropriates money from the general fund to ODE for the program and declares an emergency effective upon passage. There's an amendment at the back of your packet. It's a -1 amendment, and what it does is it repeals the section that appropriates the money.
Discussion in the committee. Senator Schrader?
I'd like to move the -1 amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Senator Gorelick, could we establish on the record what the effect of removing...
Sure. The Oregon Department of Education plans on getting the position within the omnibus budget bill, and they would absorb that position within their existing limitation.
And no doubt they will come back and talk to us in 2009 about funding it. So further discussion, Senator?
Follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So is that to... should our understanding be then that the program would go forward?
Yes, you are correct.
Before 2009?
You are correct. The program would go forward as the bill requires, and they would get the position authority within the omnibus budget bill.
I'm seeing a head nod from the Department of Education. Did you want to comment on that to that point?
Where is that nodding head?
Right here. Mr. Oh,
thank you.
Allen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen from the Department of Education, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I have not seen the amendment, but I think I have an understanding of what it does and what the committee is asking us to do.
Thank you. And so that is an affirmative that the program would start in the 2007-2009 biennium.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I believe the amendment would require us to look within the agency's current budget to see if there are savings that can be reappropriated to the position. I'm not our budget expert for our agency, so I don't know what impact that may have on other programs within the budget, but the bill, I believe, requires that the pilot program begin in the 2008-2009 year, so starting July 1st, 2008, we would need to have that position filled.
I'm hearing that as a commitment that the program will begin July 1.
Madam Chair and Senator Gorley, again, I have not had an opportunity to review the amendment, but again, I believe it's directing us to find savings within our agency budget, and so we will attempt to comply with that amendment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Carter, did you? Okay. Motion is to move the -1 amendment into House Bill 3601. Further discussion on the motion? Any objections? Motion to amend carries. Senator Schrader.
Madam Co-Chair, move House Bill 3601 as amended to the floor of the blue pass recommendation.
Senator Schrader moves House Bill 3601 as amended to the floors with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Okay, colleagues, I'm impressed. We're moving right along.
Go on, your chair.
And now we have something that might take a tad bit more of our time. I will close that work session, open a work session on Senate Bill 1087. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, you'll be getting a packet, actually two packets. The first one coming around is for Senate Bill 1087. The second is for the second bill, House Bill 3638. These are a package. They are what is probably being called the Property Crimes Package. 1087 is a referral from the November 2008 ballot, and the other bill is a straight bill with no referral, but they are connected to each other. Madam Co-Chair, I can go through the major points of the bill, but there is also a number of learned experts, including Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office, Craig Prinz. I see Senator Brzezinski is in the audience, and so I'll leave it up to you, but I can go through the major portions of the bill and the fiscal impact of it.
Since this bill comes to this committee, and it is a complex bill, comes to this committee from a policy committee in the Senate, and this is likely the only committee in which House members will have a chance to look at this bill, I would appreciate the committee's indulgence in getting a policy overview of the bill and then your fiscal. And I would invite Mr. O'Leary and Senator Brzezinski, Senator Brzezinski, it came from your committee. You're here as an expert. If you'd like to testify, you're welcome to. But Mr. O'Leary, I think you're up. Mr. Foote, would you like to join? Thank you.
Can you use a little mic here?
Yeah. And Mr. Prinz, I think. Thank you. You can't go wrong with this panel. I'm sure the answer resides in one of them. Mr. O'Leary.
Co-Chair Nolan, members of the Joint Committee, thank you very much. It's an honor to be before you today. I've prepared a summary for you of the two bills that I believe are being passed out now. It constitutes an index of the major sections of both substantive bills. It also includes a summary of the two amendments that are before you with respect to both bills, containing some technical changes that were consensus was reached among the work group that brought this bill. And then finally in that packet are section by section summaries, plain English summaries, of what each of the sections of the respective bills do. At a very high level, the package before you is two parts accountability and one part treatment or rehabilitation. It was developed in conjunction with a broad work group of public safety stakeholders convened by Senator Brzezinski with a great deal of involvement from Representatives Olson, Representative Krieger, Representative McPherson, and Representative Barker. And on the Senate side, Senator Beyer, Senator Whitsitt participated in the work group meetings, as well as I mentioned, Senator Brzezinski. We would not be here but for the leadership and assistance of the Oregon District Attorneys Association as well, who's represented by John Foote, the other participants who are supporters of this bill include the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and as you heard here, Community Corrections Directors and the Association of Oregon Counties. 1087 is the bill that contains sentence enhancements, targeted sentence enhancements toward repeat property and drug offenses, and the requirement that treatment be provided, appropriate treatment services be provided by the Department of Corrections or the supervising authority, that is community corrections, for addicted offenders. So I'm going to walk you through this very, very briefly. Senate Bill 1087, Section 1 is the legislative findings that speak to the need for both enhanced sentences and enhanced access to treatment, as well as swift and certain sanctions for offenders who fail to comply with court-ordered treatment. Section 2 enhances the penalties for extremely large quantity drug trafficking offenses. I'm going to take a side road to explain this section to you just for a moment. Currently, Oregon law provides an enhanced sentence under the sentencing guidelines for individuals who are in possession of 9 or 10 grams of, for example, methamphetamine. So there's a 10-gram threshold that gets you the highest sentence under the Oregon sentencing guidelines. The federal government, through the U.S. Attorney's Office, rarely touches a case, for example, a meth case, unless it is in excess of 500 grams or a pound of methamphetamine. What Section 2 of 1087 does is attempt to fill the void between 10 grams and 500 grams with enhanced sentences keyed to 100-gram limits and 500-gram limits. Section 3 of the bill addresses repeat drug delivery to minors and enhances sentences for individuals who are convicted of that offense. It retains the current exception, at least for a first offense, if the individual was less than 3 years older than the person who the drugs were being delivered to. Section 4 of the bill contains enhanced sentences for aggravated theft of over $10,000 when the victim is over 65. Section 5 contains drug definitions that relate back to the trafficking section. Section 6 relates to repeat drug dealers, individuals who are convicted of drug distribution for a first time under the sentencing guidelines, generally are presumed to get probation with some period of jail time. And this provision would ensure that second-time offenders do not get probation, but rather are sentenced to whatever grid block they get under the sentencing guidelines for prison. Section 7 is really the meat of the bill, and this is the section that has to do with repeat property offenders. Right now, Oregon has a repeat property offender sentencing scheme that has a list of offenses that qualify an individual for either a 13-month for lower echelon crimes or a 19-month for higher echelon crimes prison sentence, depending on the person's criminal record. Under the lower echelon crimes, a person is not eligible for the 13-month prison sentence unless that person has four or more of a specified list of property offenses. This section does two things. First, it enhances the actual sentence for repeat property offenses, currently 13 or 19 months. This enhances it to 18 or 24 months. The other thing it does is accelerate the eligibility, if you will, for an offender to receive that enhanced sentence. Instead of waiting until the fifth conviction, this section of the bill makes an offender eligible upon their second conviction. If that second conviction is either while they were on supervision for their prior conviction or within 3 years of the termination of their prior period of supervision. So this is going to capture a larger number of property offenders, and it's surgically targeted to those offenders who are conducting repeat criminal property activity. Section 8 of the bill turns to the treatment component, and what it does is create a grant program that would allow the Department of Corrections, in consultation with an advisory committee made up of public safety stakeholders, to create administrative rules for the distribution of these grants and to actually award these grants to counties for the following purposes: county jail beds, community treatment programs, county intensive supervision programs, and there is also some of that those dollars are intended to be reserved for treatment programs within DOC institutions as opposed to going out to counties. Separately in this grant section, there's the provision of funds to the Criminal Justice Commission for the purposes of drug courts across Oregon.
Section 9 of the bill makes very, very clear to trial courts, to sentencing courts, that individuals who are ordered to participate in drug and alcohol treatment as a condition of their sentence, who refuse to participate in that treatment, must be given swift and certain sanctions, including jail. Section 13 of the bill contains what we call the either-or clause. This, thank you. Mr. Prince pointing out I skipped over an important section or two. Sorry. Section 10 is the one I missed. Enhances the crime of mail theft, currently a misdemeanor, to a C felony. And Section 11 is also an important section. That limits the court's ability to downward depart, that is, to go from a prison sentence to a probation sentence on crimes that are created in the first part of this act, drug trafficking, delivery to a minor, and aggravated theft against an individual over 65. Section 12, I also skipped, has to do with the effective dates. And the short version of this is the sentencing portion of this act would be effective on crimes, if passed by the voters, on crimes committed on or after January 1, 2009. The treatment grant portion of this bill would be effective July 1, 2009. Now, before I got ahead of myself, back to the either-or clause, which is in Section 13. This is, as your staff pointed out, intended to present the voters with a choice between this alternative and Initiative Petition 40, which appears to be headed for the November 2008 ballot. And Section 13 simply says that if both this referral and Initiative Petition 40 get a majority of votes, then the measure with the most votes controls. And finally, Section 15 is the implementing language for the actual referral of this measure to the ballot. Now, I'm going to mention this in passing. There is an amendment before you, the -A10 amendment, which would include one more section to Senate Bill 1087, and that would insert a severability clause. And essentially, that severability clause would say that if any portion of this measure is found unconstitutional, that the remainder of the measure stays in force. There are three other small tweaks to 1087 that are contained in the A10 amendment. Several of them have to do with the repeat property offender section, and again, this language is intended to tighten the language and ensure that there are no loopholes, and ensure that offenders who have a prior predicate property conviction who get another predicate property conviction are eligible for that presumptive prison sentence. There's also a change to the findings in Section 1 of the bill. The A. Gross version that you are looking at has a section which speaks to both the need for increased access to treatment and the need for swift and certain sanctions for refusal to participate in treatment, and the amendment breaks those two up into separate findings. And then finally, the -10 amendment contains stronger language than is currently in Senate Bill 1087 with respect to questions that were raised in Judiciary Committee about whether or not the treatment section of the bill creates any kind of fundamental right to treatment. And the answer is no. And the -A10 makes that very clear by inserting language that in effect says nothing in this act requires the Department of Corrections or the supervising authority, that is community corrections, to provide treatment to every individual within the supervising authority's jurisdiction. That is a summary of 1087, and I'll proceed with a brief summary of...
We're only under work session on 1087. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Foote, did you want to make any comments?
Co-Chair Nolan, Co-Chair Schrader, members of the committee, my name is John Foote, and I have the pleasure of serving as the DA in Clackamas County. I just got involved in this effort to sort of find some new way to work with property criminals more than a year ago when I was also serving as president of the Oregon Attorneys Association, and it sort of carried over here past my term. first of all, because we're in front of your committee, I think this is a good place to acknowledge that DA recognized that the state does not have unlimited financial resources. And quite frankly, it was one of the considerations that district attorneys took to reach this proposal. As you know, the projections for the cost here are considerably less than Measure 40, and that wasn't the first consideration for DAs. The first consideration was public safety, but to find something that was less expensive that we felt could still do the job was something we wanted to pursue. The second thing, before I talk about the reason why DAs support this bill, I want to mention something else. There's been some concern expressed among my membership and others about that this is maybe an attempt by some or whoever to undermine Measure 11 through emphasizing treatment. And obviously that is not the intent of the DAs, and I don't think everything I've been told is that's not the intent of this bill. This bill, in fact, enhances punishment for property offenders. And more importantly, as everyone knows, Measure 11 is about violent personal crimes. It's a very different subject than property crime. While property crime is important and can really affect the quality of life, it's not the same thing. So these are very separate issues in our mind. They're not related. And I just wanted to put that on the record for our membership as well as everybody else. Let me tell you briefly why DAs support this proposal and have supported it for quite a while. First of all, it increases punishments for repeat property offenders. And if you're in our business and you work in a local community, you know what an enormous problem this is. We simply are unable to incapacitate people who will not change their behavior and victimize communities. Like Senator Pozanski just told me today, I don't think he heard me mentioning, he lost his car this morning. Our latest known victim. And when you find the people that are doing this, it is a career. These people are doing it all the time. I'm not talking about the isolated. The isolated person isn't going to be affected by this bill. We specifically propose first-time offenders get a break for presumptive probation. We're talking about the people who are in it all the time. And this bill gives us much more ability to say, you're going to have a timeout. You're going away. That's the number one thing. And it's going to take fewer victims to be able to do that. This is a really important point. DAs support treatment. That's another thing I wanted to tell you. We support treatment that we know is effective, however. I think everybody does. We can debate what effective means. One of the things that's in this bill that we very much support, I think it's this bill, or is it 3638, one of the two, is a provision for independent evaluations of treatment programs. The way the structure works now, treatment programs are evaluated by the people that are running them. Typically, someone will start a program, well-intentioned people, like my friend Scott Taylor, will start a program and then want it evaluated. And we'll go out and hire somebody to do it. That is inherently a problem. Mm-hmm. Not because anybody's dishonest, but you just don't evaluate things that way. You need somebody independent. So this bill, 3638, provides the Oroville Criminal Justice Commission will conduct independent evaluations. We want those evaluations to be rigorous, up to high standards. That conversation is for another day. We think that's a very important step because the truth is there's a lot of debate about how much these programs really work and whether they're a good investment. So this gives us a chance to do that. That's a good thing. Finally, this bill, I think, helps restore, these bills together help restore truth in sentencing. And that'll be more about 3638 than it is this bill. So those are, in summary, the reasons why DA support them. We appreciate the time and effort the legislature is putting into making this happen. Be glad to answer any questions, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Philip, Mr. Prince. Okay, fine.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you. I had a gross omission in my earlier testimony listing the members of the work group, the legislator members of the work group. Representative Shields also was a participant in the work group, and I did not want to leave him out.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, I'd like to get a brief review of the fiscal on it and then open it up for questions. Mr. Wilson?
Madam Co-Chair, in the packet for 1087 is a draft fiscal. It's only draft because you still have to ratify it. On the surface, it's indeterminate because this is a ballot measure, or it will go out on the ballot, so it really doesn't have a fiscal until it passes. And there are potential costs to the Secretary of State around any type of ballot measure, depending on how many are on the ballot and how many pages have to be in the voter's manual and everything. But if you turn to the second page of the fiscal, we've included some estimates of what this will cost as it rolls out. For the present biennium, 07-09, Department of Corrections is likely to see a fiscal of just over $750,000 as more people are sentenced to prison instead of probation. We'll probably likely see a need for about 120 more beds by the end of the biennium. That's not a problem because we have a brand new prison just coming online, so there's no new construction or rental beds needed. That would have to be open slightly earlier than what is projected right now under the current caseload projections. The impact grows, though. In 09-11, the DOC impact grows to a little over $62 million, anticipating about 1,400 beds. And then by 2013-15 biennium, we're looking at about $106 million cost to DOC with almost 1,700 beds. That starts to raise a question about prison construction. 1,700 beds is just under a new prison. The Madras prison, which just opened, is around 1,800 beds, between 1,700 and 1,800 beds. So there would likely have to be some prison construction unless there can be that many beds identified, most likely out of state for rental, which creates a whole other series of issues for you. So if you did go ahead and approve this bill, it is likely that you'll see Department of Corrections coming back in the next budget process asking for acceleration of their construction schedule for the Junction City facility. There will have to be some other measures taken in between the time that new prison opens and becomes available. Debt service cost roughly on a prison of that size will be about $25 million a biennium once all the bonds are fully rolled out. So that will give you over about 25 or 26 years. So it'll give you sort of an idea of that. The grant program that's created by this, there is no set amount. That would be set through the budget process starting in the 09-11 biennium. But I do understand a number of roughly $40 million has been discussed as what the locals and the DOC have sort of said is an amount that could start to fill the need on the treatment side. The impact of the Public Defense Services Commission and Judicial Department is indeterminate at this time, but there will be likely impact, maybe not this biennium, but some in future biennia. But all these folks that are part of this bill are already committing crimes. Many are going on probation. Now they will likely be going into the DOC institution, which may change some of the plea bargaining and the other parts of the negotiations between prosecutors and defendants.
Thank you. Thank you. Colleagues, this isn't among the most important bills that the legislature will hear this session, and so I want to give some leeway to discussion, but I intend to not run this committee into the wee hours of the morning tonight, so I would ask us to focus our questions. Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you, Chair Nolan. Mr. O'Leary, there is no precedent for the either-or dueling ballot measure seen here. Legislative Council has provided a written opinion that, you know, to my untrained legal mind, was a little like following a rabbit through Alice in Wonderland, but they came to the conclusion that it would be it was more likely to be constitutional than unconstitutional. Does the Department of Justice have a position?
Okay, hello, Senator Whitsitt. Thank you for that question. I spoke to Attorney General Hardy Myers, and he authorized me to convey that he has, in his office, has evaluated the issue, and the term he used is he has a high degree of confidence that that provision is constitutional.
Thank you. Follow, please.
Hello, Senator. Yes.
Mr. Leary, on the ballot measure, the way it's set up is sort of a numbers game, and So I'd like to get on the record is if we have 100% of a population and 30% vote no, that only leaves 70% that could possibly vote yes. And if you divide that 70% into two pieces, it's likely that you're not going to have a majority if we're talking about the whole picture. If each ballot measure stands alone, then either if you have a 30% no vote and a 35% yes vote or a 31% yes vote on one ballot measure, you could pass the measure. So which is it? Is it, do they stand alone and each one of them, the percentage is stands alone, or is it a whole picture when you tie the two together?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Whitsitt, I will do my best to answer that question. It's a good question. The way I understand this would operate is that each measure stands alone. If neither measure gets a majority vote, neither measure is enacted. If both measures receive a majority vote, then the measure with the most votes controls.
One follow-up. Yes, Senator.
And the, either one of these ballot measures then could be passed under the scenario that I suggested with 31% of the vote or something like that. I mean, if 30% voted no and 31% voted yes, but the other ballot measure was defeated, then the prevailing ballot title would be the one that got the 31%. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Whitsitt, I don't believe that is correct. I think that in order to be passed by the voters, the individual ballot measure must get a majority vote of the votes cast for that ballot measure. If neither of these get a majority vote, neither become effective. If IP 40 gets a majority vote and this alternative does not, IP 40 becomes effective. If IP 40 does not get a majority vote, but this alternative does, the alternative becomes effective. And then the last scenario is if both get a majority vote, whichever one has more votes is effective.
One further clarification.
Yes, Senator, it's important for us all to understand this.
If only 60% of the voting population votes on ballot title 1087, and half plus one of them pass the measure, and it passes by, and say IP 40 fails, then the 50% plus one of the people that voted for that ballot title would pass it, but it would only be about 31% of the people who were there in that ballpark of the people who voted in the entire election.
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Whitsitt, I believe that's right. If you're assuming that only 60% of the population actually vote, I think that's correct.
Well, it's a likelihood in that unless voters vote for both measures, if you assume that 30% of the people aren't going to vote for it, either of the measures, then the other 70% are going to either vote for both of them, or if we divide equally, this would be a very small percentage of the total people. I mean, I don't want to beat it to death, but I mean, it's a different scene than we've ever seen before. Now, why do you put that on the record?
Interesting. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Senator. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Very interesting point Senator Whitsitt has made there. My questions concern the fiscal impact to this, and reading through Mr. Wilson's fiscal impact, I think the impact in terms of the Department of Corrections is fairly straightforward, and we do have, I think, a very good system to project the impacts, and we have a good track record of being well within the confines of it. I'm concerned about Section 8, which talks about the grant program. And in Mr. Wilson's discussion, he says there is no amount set for these costs for the grants and DOC treatment programs by the bill, and it's assumed that the amount would be set through the budget process starting in 9/11, and he mentioned a $40 million price tag on it. My question is, first of all, is the $40 million that's discussed here, is this additional money, or does this include the money that is already funded in these areas?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Morgan, that is intended to be additional money over and above what is funded in those areas.
Okay.
Call.
Senate? Oh, thank you very much. On the first line of Section 8, it says the Department of Correction shall, and then it goes through to list the different kinds of grants that will be funded. What does shall mean? Does shall mean that if this passes into law, there shall be a grant program, but it's undefined in the amount of it?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Morgan, the shall in that sentence is intended to ensure that whatever dollar amount the legislature appropriates under this grant program is allocated for those purposes listed in Section 8, both by the Department of Corrections for those listed purposes and separately by the Criminal Justice Commission for drug courts.
We have a follow-up.
Yes.
What I think I'm trying to get out of this is that it's mandatory that there has to be a grant program. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Morgan, it's certainly the grant program is created by 1087, and I suppose that in theory the legislature could decide not to fund it, and then there would be nothing for the Department of Corrections or the Criminal Justice Commission to allocate. What I can tell you, which is in response to how you began that your first question, is that the work group that met through the course of the last few months on this issue did receive input from the Department of Corrections and the Community Corrections Directors about the need for additional drug and alcohol treatment resources in the criminal justice system. And it was that input that resulted in the $40 million figure as the figure that folks in the course of the discussion were using as a bookmark as what we would like to do. I'd also like to put on the record that the governor is committed to putting that amount, that $40 million figure, biennial figure, in his next recommended budget for purposes of these grants.
If I'm going to clarify here, for purposes of the way we budget, this would become current law if the voters approve it, and therefore it becomes something that the legislature treats as an expectation for funding.
Can I have one more?
Yes, Representative.
If there is an insufficient level of funding, are the counties and the local jurisdictions mandated any way to provide services that aren't completely paid for by this program?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Morgan, that's a great question. I just want to take a moment to look at the language. It certainly was not intended, and I want to take a moment.
Madam Co-Chair, if I might, while he's reading there, with the looking at this particularly from the perspective of the rural counties, these are services that are much needed, but with the impending budget crises that a number of the counties are going to be facing, to put a mandate for service on them when there is just going to be a horrible crunch for funding would be a really bad thing to do, I think. And so I would just like to get something clearly on the record that shows whether or not the counties and the local jurisdictions would be on the hook for paying for these programs if the state is taking full responsibility for paying for them, and there is no expectation that the local jurisdictions, the counties, and the smaller jurisdictions would have to pay for these programs.
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Morgan, thank you for the extra moment to refresh on the language, and it is definitely a mandate as to the state and not to the counties. I'd further add that any argument that could be made that it creates any requirement on the counties would be, I think, quickly rebutted by the language that is contained in your dash 10 amendment to 1087 that says that nothing requires this, nothing in this act requires the supervising authority or the Department of Corrections to provide treatment to any individual within its custody.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam.
Mr. Wilson, you have a...
Madam Coacher, I do want to make it clear, though, that, I mean, for example, one of the purposes or one of the uses of the grants is to help out with jail costs. That is a local function now and would continue. The state is, under this grant program, would be providing assistance to counties to help with jail costs. So I want to make sure that the mandate for operation of jails still applies. The state is helping out in this case.
Thank you. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. O'Leary, I'd like to, and thank you, Madam Co-Chair, I'd like to ask about the stronger language regarding no right to treatment. What discussions did you all have around the potential for disparate treatment, different treatment, given the history of discrimination that's real, that does exist in the overall administration of justice? What are the guards, what are the protections against disparate treatment when getting treatment is left to the discretion of the judge or the correction system?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Gordley, excellent question. There is nothing, first, there is nothing in the language of the bill that speaks directly to that issue. There was a great deal of discussion within the work group about how best to craft this section to both require... If I could back up just a little bit and give you a big picture answer. What we know from the Department of Corrections is that 85% of the repeat property offender population currently coming into their custody are moderately to severely addicted to drugs and alcohol. We also know that only 12% of that population currently receive intensive drug and alcohol treatment. And finally, we know that about 49% of that population recidivate within 3 years of their release, that is, commit a felony offense. So the big picture issue that we were trying to get to was requiring greater access to treatment than is currently available both at the Department of Corrections and at the community level. But the way this bill purports to implement it is absolutely to give the discretion to the Department of Corrections to determine who is the appropriate recipient of those services. And the guideposts that the bill gives have to do with risk. And I'd point you to Section 1A of the A engrossed, I believe it's the A engrossed bill 1087, that says that individuals that the appropriate treatment services that are funded by this section are to be provided to individuals who are at a high or medium risk of reoffending and who have a moderate to high treatment needs. And a separate part of this section, I believe it's this section, it may be the companion bill, indicates that the Department of Corrections is to use actuarial tools to determine who are appropriate offenders for the receipt of these treatment dollars or services. So to the extent that there are those objective sideboards around it, I think there is some guarantee that there would not be inappropriate decisions made around that. That being said, this is something that additional flesh can be put on this bone, these bones by administrative rule, and that's definitely something that I'd be happy to have a conversation with you and Max Williams about to see how we can address that issue.
I appreciate the last part of your response, because history tells a story about what we may need to address
by administrative rule. Historically, we know that people of color in our system get harsher sentences, get less access to treatment. And so, again, what will we do intentionally, aggressively, to ensure that as this rolls out, as this policy is implemented, we don't go down that path of disparate treatment, different treatment. And we just have to be absolute in our intent about this. I want to be real clear about that. Because training is also suggested here, training for the corrections professionals who are going to be involved in this, and more training and sensitivity for judges as well. We have a report. It's not gathering dust, I hope, but the report, the 1994 report of the Supreme Court Task Force that looked at racial and ethnic bias in the judicial system and our part of our administration of justice should be revisited, if it hasn't already been revisited in your work preparing this, these two measures. That work needs to be revisited, and we need to draw on the lessons from that work. And perhaps you can share with us, if that work was revisited as a part of your development of these two.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gordley, Craig Prinz, for the record, from the Criminal Justice Commission. Senator Gordley, the 94 study I'm familiar with was when Edwin Peterson was the Chief Justice. Chief Justice Peterson's been working with us for the racial profiling work that we've done. And we did not talk to Chief Justice Peterson about this issue, but I wanted to make it clear what Mr. O'Leary was talking about with a risk assessment score that's an actuarial tool. What you're using is objective data, and it's what the Department of Corrections uses currently to triage who to serve. They try to serve the highest risk offenders first. I think using an objective criteria like that eliminates a lot of the hazards of personal discretion that might be based upon bias of the persons making the discretion, and that is one of the things that we've looked at using that type of objective criteria also for. It's the same thing that I think more and more jails and more sentencing situations are being used for decisions like matrixing out of jails, mm-hmm. and what is the appropriate risk assessment. So I hope that addresses that. But to answer, did we talk to Chief Justice Peterson about this issue? To be honest, Senator, we've been moving so fast we did not get a chance to. So I appreciate being able to put on the record those things about the objective criteria.
Well, lastly, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I appreciate the responses. I appreciate that I'm hearing that there's a consciousness about all of this, and I do encourage you to have that conversation with Justice Peterson, because I hear what you're saying about it, the objectivity of the instruments analysis and all of that, but subjectivity will still enter in. It will still enter in. It'll happen.
Thank you. Thank you for that line of questioning. Representative Shields.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think I'll be supporting this bill, and I think it really is a tough measure on property criminals. And for example, under this proposal, if someone steals a credit card and goes out and uses it two or three times in the same night, they're going to prison, and that's subject to the prosecutor's discretion, of course. But I also think it's important to know that a very big part of this is the treatment component, that $40 million, and that's where the majority of my support will be coming from for this proposal. In the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, in all of the Department of Corrections budgets last time, we doubled the amount of treatment dollars behind bars last session, but that only doubled it to about $12 or $13 million. So this is a significant infusion. I also wanted to put on the record that I think it's important for us when it comes budget time that we're going to have some discretion on where to put those $40 million, and that we do not put $39 million into jail beds and $1 million into the provision of services. So I just want us to keep it in mind that, in my view at least, the majority of that should be going to actual drug and alcohol treatment.
Thank you.
Senator Carter.
Thank you very much. I want to ditto Representative Shields' comments and also Senator Gortley, because that was going to be my question, since your data shows that at least 85% of the people who go into the jail system, they go as a result of being addiction. And I have to tell you, I was a no vote on this bill, and I'm changing my mind as we sit here tonight, because of the strength of the treatment piece. Because you know what, when I first came to the legislature, the money that we're using for our prison system today was used for education and human services. And something has gone awry in our society when we think that jail is the only answer to be able to deal with people in our society. Somewhere along the line, we have to strengthen our prevention piece. I know you can call me savior of the world if you want to, because I don't believe that we can save everybody, but I believe that there are some things that we should do in using our dollars to try to keep so many people out of prison, because, you know, we pay, what, I don't know, you guys know the number, $27,500, $30,000 a year for a bed in prison, when we spend $5,000 a term in a community college system. So somewhere along the line, I want to see a balance, because honestly, if I were Senator Pruszynski tonight, I'd probably be in tears about somebody stealing my car and be angry as all outdoors. Don't get me wrong, I don't mean to sound like I'm waffling, but at the same time, and I have to tell you, Mr. Prince, being with you guys, I feel a sense of hope about the future of us having a better balance toward the whole the issue of prevention as well as sanctions, and I think both are necessary instead of just sanctions alone, and that is real important to me, because I was going to ask you about Section 10, and I understood it after you explained it to Representative Morgan, because I just don't see how we can sanction people continuously without doing anything around treatment. So I appreciate this measure, and as a result of the testimony tonight, Senator Pruszynski, I will be changing my vote to a yes vote.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to be supporting this also. I am very pleased to see see this proposal that's as much about how we're spending our money and how we can spend it effectively to fight crime, and the ultimate goal is to make us and our neighborhoods safer. How do we make our communities safer? That's what we're all trying to make sure happens here with the resources that we have available. I'm especially pleased about the money, as Representative Shields has mentioned, the money that's going into treatment and drug courts. After working really hard in the 07 session to try to send more money to treatment and to drug courts, we were able to increase it a little bit, not enough, and you know, you do what you can, you take a step forward and know that you're moving in the right direction, but feel frustrated that you didn't do everything you wish you could have. That's how I felt about it. I wanted to thank Representative Shields for his leadership on this in our subcommittee, public safety subcommittee, and over the past months. I also wanted to mention that the Criminal Justice Commission staff and members and public safety coordinating councils all around the state have been working on this for quite some time, for some years, and I wanted to thank them for their assistance to me in helping me understand the issues and work together on how to make our communities safer. So I'm really pleased to see a proposal that's about sentencing, it's about drug courts, and about effective treatment.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I have three quick questions about the treatment section. The first one is that the same way Representative Shields was eager to get on the record commitments about where some of this money was going to go with respect to beds versus treatment, I'd like your comments on commitments about providing the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission with adequate resources to do these independent reviews. And the reason that I would like that to happen is that I think the independent review is cut two ways. First of all, to make sure that the treatment providers are providing programs that are effective and expeditiously move people through. And given that the sanctions are so high here for a failure to successfully complete a treatment program, I'd like to know that there aren't any obstacles in the way of an offender to do so. I have a program in my district called LifeWorks that has a problem getting people graduated through no seeming problem of the offender. And then last but not least, I'd like your comments on how many shots at treatment a particular offender gets before there is some opportunity to rule them unlikely to ever succeed in a treatment program.
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Johnson, I'll do my best to answer that latter. You do have my assurance that implicit in this, you have my explicit assurance that implicit in this bill is the need to provide the Criminal Justice Commission with the resources necessary to conduct the independent evaluation of the programs that are funded by this section. We clearly want to be true to and this would all apply to Senate Bill 267, evidence-based practices. We want to be true to that intent. We want to have good return on investment for the taxpayer dollars, and we want to be able to measure and see that what the interventions that we are doing have a relationship to enhanced public safety. That is the number one priority. As to how many bites of the apple, your second question, that's a tough one for me to answer. There are different answers depending on what an offender is being and what sentencing structure an offender is being sentenced. Under the repeat property offender section of 1087, basically an offender gets one bite to be put on probation for their first repeat property offender predicate offense. They're put on probation, they're ordered to do treatment, and depending on what treatment provider they go to and the reasonableness or a lack of reasonableness of the judge who they report to for their probation, someone can make the decision about whether or not they're compliant or not and whether or not their probation is revoked. But if they receive a second repeat property offender predicate offense and therefore are sentenced to the Department of Corrections custody, they have one chance, and this speaks to what's in the second bill before you, 3638, they have one chance to participate in the Department of Corrections intensive alcohol and drug program called the Alternative Incarceration Program. And here's why. If an offender who is eligible under the eligibility requirements that are in 3638 gets into a DOC alternative incarceration program, they can actually earn a reduction in their sentence over and above what they earn for good institutional behavior. And what 3638 does is say you only get one chance to earn that sentence reduction. If you earn it, that's it. Hope you don't come back, because if you come back, you are never getting a sentence reduction because of completion of treatment again at the Department of Corrections. So to the extent that the contents of these two bills speak to that, that does answer that question.
Mr. Foote? Can I add something? Chair Schrader, Senator Johnson, members of the committee, in listening to what Joe's saying, I want everyone to remember, if they could, please, to inmates, other than Measure 11, are eligible for earned time. I was actually around prosecuting when the committee were there. Actually, I was an experienced prosecutor, but it was great. And the principle is that inmates can earn off 20% of their time already for treatment and behaving. This time caught in AIP is an addition. Earned time remains. Inmates can still get earned time unless they're in on a Measure 11 charge. So, and actually, I think they can get it above the minimum in Measure 11. But so I just wanted to make that point. The other thing, Senator Carter, you said something about, you know, that we just punish. So I'd just like to throw out a number that just, because it always surprises me, and I'll have to ask folks what they think about it, but
what they think before I tell them the number, but the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission a couple of years ago produced a document that I still have because I was so surprised by it. And the percentage of convicted felons who are in prison in Oregon is 16%. We are not sending all felons to prison in Oregon. We just aren't doing it. And I don't know what this bill is going to do. It's going to change that number, but it's not going to change it dramatically, because the group we're talking about here is a targeted group of people. Not first-time offenders, not people who come once and make a mistake, but people who are in a career lifestyle. So I'd just like to throw that number out as a perspective. Feels like we're just growing, 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 but the mass group of convicted felons are in our community. They're not in prison. So, thank you.
One last comment. I would hope that as this, assuming that it's validated by the voters and as it matures, that we attempt as a legislative body to monitor the performance of the treatment programs in a really serious way. I mean, this is somewhat akin to a flight school where somebody learns to fly and they've got 300 hours and they never solo. I just want to make sure that we have the kind of programs that give people a fair chance at succeeding, because we are frankly putting a lot of money into, and I hate to use the word industry, but or profession of treatment. And when the sanctions are severe, I want to make sure that we have efficacious programs and that we're doing the very best we can to assure that the provider community performs up to the highest standards that we expect in terms of moving people successfully through their programs, and that they don't just hang on to them to keep the money spigot turned on.
Thank you, Senator.
Co-Chair Nolan, if I could just point Senator Johnson also to an additional section of the bill. Not only does the Criminal Justice Commission require to do periodic evaluations, but the legislature specifically in the bill, it says that the appropriate legislative committee shall periodically conduct oversight hearings of the effectiveness of this section. That appears in Section 8, Sub 3A.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In the last line of Section 8, the decision to order treatment is within the discretion of the court. Who is it that determines the drug addicted piece?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Nolan. Representative Hannah, that is the line you just mentioned, sub 5 under Section 8. The first thing I want to tell you is deleted by the A10 amendment. And in its place is going to be language that says nothing requires the supervising authority of the DOC to provide treatment to any individual under the supervising authority or department's custody. The reason we deleted that language that you just cited, the reason we put that in the first place was to try to make extra clear that the order to participate in treatment should be one that's made by the court and is not a matter of right for an individual criminal defendant. But as we looked at that and sat with that a little bit, we realized that that may have some unintended consequences in and of itself. We realized that Section 8 is really empowering the Department of Corrections, which is the answer to your question, to decide who the appropriate candidates for treatment are. And so we decided to replace that language in the A. Gross Bill's Section 8, Sub 5, with the language I just read onto the record that makes very clear what we were trying to say, which is this doesn't create any enforceable right. This is not an opportunity for an individual defendant to sue the department or subvert the sentence that the court imposes.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up, and I appreciate we're jumping back and forth on the amendments. Also within that Section 8 is the provide appropriate treatment services to drug-addicted persons in the custody of the department. And given that there are those within the department who maybe already missed their opportunity, how many people within DOC currently would qualify?
Co-Chair Nolan and Representative Hannah, I am going to have to use a lifeline for that question. That's a good one, and I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I have to get back to you.
Co-Chair Nolan and Representative Hannah,
That's I don't have the number off the top of my head. When we talked the way that Section 8 is put together.
Now, gentlemen, when I brought you up, I said we would have all the answers for this panel.
Let me find the...
Can we get that to
you?
Yeah, sure.
We don't need to.
Okay.
Thank you. No.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. No questions, just comments, if I may. First off, this is a very difficult bill for me to vote yes on. It's been my history, I think, in this body since I've been here to vote no on all referrals to the people that were not constitutional amendments. And that position has been taken because I think the people elected me here to do a job and not pass the buck, if you wish. Having said that, there are some things that are taking place in this bill that I am in favor of and that will persuade me to vote differently on it, and one is the treatment portion that's there. However, I do have one really major concern with that as far as the treatment portion. And I hope I'm proven wrong with this, but I have a concern that it still is not an adequate amount of treatment for the need that's going to be there, thus setting up a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure of treatment, which then means that some other legislature coming here at some point in the future we'll be looking at a bill to do away with the treatment and increase the incarceration, and I think that would be a terrible disaster as such. However, I'm going to trust the members of the group here and the gentlemen that are in front of us that as this moves forward we pay attention to this, and if additional resources are needed in the future to make this treatment viable, we would seek. You'd come to us and seek those additional resources. The other thing, of course, that I've been concerned about for a long time, this is an industry in our state, and we're build as far as prisons were concerned, and we've been told that in one scenario here, we're 100 beds away from having to build another prison. And, I don't know how many prison beds we can build and keep up with. But in light of that, the other reason for supporting the bill is the inclusion, I think it's Section 13 that you have here, which will probably give us some opportunity to spend a little less money for prison beds than we might under the other measure that will likely be in front of the voters this fall. Though I would offer a word of caution with this. The caution is always that you get enough of these measures on the bill, the voters will just get in to say no to all of them, and both measures will go down. So, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I wanted to explain, since I am making a significant departure from my historical record here in this body and going to vote yes on a bill that I would normally be voting no on.
Representative, that is significant. Thank you. Conversation. Senator Winters hasn't spoken yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up on the issue of treatment, because you mentioned that, and I thought you said currently 85% of individuals have alcohol and drug addiction. If you take that percentage and those who may be prosecuted under this bill, under property crimes, what do you think that number will be? Number one, whether that percentage would hold or even greater. I'm thinking about the whole treatment package. Can you give us some idea of what that number you think would be?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Winters, first let me clarify. It's the 85% figure I told you is among the population that come to the Department of Corrections under the repeat property offender sentence as it currently is. The answer to your question, I'm pleased with the caveat that I'm speculating. I have no data on which to really back this up, but I suspect both from my own past practice in the public safety system that it would hold at that figure, if not be a little bit higher.
Just a comment, follow-up. In Marion County, as most of you know, we did put together, just dealing with the methamphetamine epidemic, our task force here and RDA, who was working with me on those issues, and also is one who's worked on 1087. And those figures that you gave us are figures that he talks about in our community. And he also talks about that we can't continue to do just the incarceration without the treatment piece. Along that line of treatment, however, and I do think it's very important because there is a different treatment modality if we're talking cocaine and heroin than if we're talking meth addiction. The length of time that it takes for that treatment is a lot longer, I understand, than the others. And it's you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that means that the investment should be greater and that we're not fast-tracking people through. It goes along with what the good Senator Johnson says, that we're not setting people up for failure, that we truly expect to make those investments to give them an opportunity to really be rehabilitated so they can come back to the community to be productive citizens.
Excellent point, Senator. Thank you. Senator Gordley, one more comment.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Briefly, Mr. O'Leary, when you come back with the numbers how many people would be currently eligible, please disaggregate the information, race, gender, ethnicity, by institution.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. We've had a very good discussion of this. I think we all understand the bill reasonably well, although those who worked on it for quite some time understand it better than we do. I would entertain a motion on the amendment. Representative Shields.
Madam Chair, I move the -10 amendment into Senate Bill 1087.
Representative Shields moves the -10 amendment into, I guess, the A-10 amendment into Senate Bill 1087. Discussion on the motion to amend. Objections? Seeing none, the amendment carries. I would entertain a motion on the main bill. Senator Schrader.
Move 1087 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Schrader moves Senate Bill 1087A as amended to the floors with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Senator Monroe.
Thank you. Gives me a great deal of comfort to know that every district attorney in the state of Oregon supports this measure, that every police organization supports this measure, that my colleagues who have police experience, both Republican and Democrat, in this body support this measure. They know a lot more about it than I do, and that gives me a great deal of comfort and allows me to sleep well with my aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Shields.
Just in closing, Madam Co-Chair, I do think that in an issue of this magnitude, it is appropriate for us to give the voters a choice. And the choice that we're asking them to decide is whether or not this approach of increased sentences for repeat property offenders plus drug treatment is the choice that they would prefer over a mandatory sentencing approach for first-time offenders where the offenders are just warehoused without drug treatment.
Thank you. Any objections to the motion to move the bill to the floors? Seeing none, motion carries. Senator Prezonsky will carry on the Senate floor. Representatives McPherson and Olson will co-carry on the House floor. Close that work session. Gentlemen, you're not done. Open a work session on House Bill 3638.
Co-Chair Nolan, members.
Mr. O'Leary, please, get us going.
Co-Chair Nolan, members of the Joint Committee, again, for the record, Joe O'Leary, Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Advisor. House Bill 3638 is the companion to Senate Bill 1087. Unlike 1087, this bill is not a referral. This bill is a straight legislative enactment. And at the highest level, it does the following things. It creates tough new restrictions to the alternative incarceration program, and specifically to eligibility for the time reduction that offenders can earn for participating in DOC's alternative incarceration program. In addition, it also restricts voting rights, specifically the voting rights of individuals who are convicted of felonies who are housed in county jails. The next thing this bill does is create a mandate for county jails to conduct national criminal history checks whenever an offender is brought in at intake. And that, I should say quickly, that mandate is to be done at state, carried out at state expense. The last thing that House Bill 3638 does is contain language around the implementation of the drug treatment and drug court and jail bed grants that are contained in the referral that you just approved, Senate Bill 1087. I'm happy to provide you a more detailed analysis, but I want to pause and see if you would like me to continue.
I think the answer is we'll see if there are any questions. I think that will probably suffice. Mr. Wilson, would you walk us through the fiscal, please?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, the fiscal here is in your packet also for House Bill 3638. There is no, at this time, estimated fiscal on for 07-09, and there is roughly a $4.1 million fiscal estimated for the next biennium, 09-11 biennium. That fiscal is mainly in the Department of Corrections, again, as there is less time that people can be released early for participation in the IP program, as well as the constriction of the population that's eligible for that program due to the provisions of the bill. That's what drives the fiscal. There is no fiscal in 07-09 in part because there's already a waiting list for this program within the department, so it's likely that there'll be people going through this program that are still eligible even after the effective date of the measure. There's an indeterminate for the Judicial and Public Defense Services Commission, but we would not expect a significant impact on there. So by about 2013-15, as you roll out this bill, the impact would be almost $12 million and require roughly 200 more beds in terms of prison population.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Discussion on this bill? Senator Goldberg.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. O'Leary, what currently is the law with regard to felons in jail voting?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Gordley, currently an individual who is convicted of a felony who is in the Department of Corrections custody is prohibited from voting under statute. However, that same prohibition does not currently apply to an individual who has been convicted of a felony who happens to be housed at a local jail, for example, because they were sentenced to less than 12 months as a sentence and are therefore a local control offender.
So that latter piece is what's being added to statute. And how, does this provision align with what other states are doing?
Co-Chair Nolan, Senator Gordley, I don't have a very good answer for that. I've not done a state-by-state analysis. I am under the impression, however, that Oregon's statutes with respect to people who have been convicted of felonies
being permitted to vote is a more permissive statute than many states. My understanding is that many more states are much more restrictive on the voting rights of individuals who have been convicted of a crime, but I can do some research on that for you.
Okay, thank you. And last question. Mr. Wilson, thank you. Did you say this would require an additional 200 beds upon full implementation?
Madam Chair, Senator Gormley, that is right. Roughly 200 beds.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To the voting piece, are there any cases where a convicted felon who because of overcrowding or something would be like under house arrest, and in the cases where they would have a band or something that mandated they stay in one place, and does this apply to that if they are under county supervision?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Hanna, great question, which requires me to actually look at the language that we use, if you'd give me a moment.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
While you're looking, maybe a different question.
Well, it's kind of along the same line, so it's just along the same line, because that came to mind, and as we've talked about public safety and how we handle these things, and then it runs around to the idea of how would that even potentially be monitored? I mean, how would a county elections person even monitor that ruling?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, Section 6 of 3638 says on line 33, when a defendant is sentenced to a term of incarceration, the defendant is deprived of all rights and privileges described in subsection 3 until the defendant is released from incarceration on line 35. So in the scenario you brought up where there was a release to house arrest or with an electronic bracelet, my understanding is that this would not prohibit that person from voting. I think it's clear from the statutes that when we say incarceration in this scenario, we mean in a cell, in the custody of the supervising authority or the Department of Corrections. I don't know the answer to the other part of how will this be applied. I am not an expert on that type of thing. I don't know if anyone else has an answer.
Mr. Foote?
Co-Chair Nolan, Representative Hanna, I think you also have to take into consideration here vote by mail and the typical length of a jail sentence. I would guess that most jail sentences in Oregon are less than 15 days. I mean, that's just a ballpark. So most people in jail are going to be out sometime during vote by mail. That's my guess, as a practical matter. I may be wrong about that, but I think the most people in jail on a long sentence are very much a minority of the people in jail. That gets to a second question. A lot of the folks we're dealing with, are they going to run home and look for the ballot? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, as a practical matter, I think, you know, it's probably going to come down to where they mail an address, and they can get home and vote in time, then they can vote. That's kind of the way it works in a prison. If you get out while you're in prison and there's still time to vote, you can vote right now.
To follow up, Madam Chair, I get your point. The point I was making is, if we've looked at the fiscal, and do our county elections folks understand what this ruling will mean when it gets to the county level? So, I mean, touche, but they still have to understand it when it gets there, and
right.
Trying to make sure we get that straight before they have questions.
Okay.
Chair Nolan, if I could just interrupt you now, if we just simply said that the jails shouldn't accept ballots, we're probably going to be okay. Because the only way somebody's going to get it then is if they're not in jail.
That's true. Good point.
Senator Prasansky, you had an answer to one of the previous questions.
I think I do. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Gormley, I'd like to try to respond to part of the questions that were asked. When we were looking at the work, we've been looking at the bills, we have to keep in mind there is another initiative petition, 132, which has been authorized to collect signatures. We do not know at this point whether or not, at least I do not know whether there are signatures being gathered at this point or not, but I do believe they have everything in place to do that. In that initiative, it would actually prohibit not only felons, but also all misdemeanors. from being able to vote, no matter where they can be incarcerated, if they're incarcerated on that particular crime. What we were attempting to do was look at what were the different options that we may want to consider, if any, and also looking at when we realized that we currently have a prohibition on felons who are serving their time in the state system from prohibiting from voting while they're actually incarcerated. I believe we have an equal protection issue for those felons who are allowed to vote, who are in the county facilities. And so this is really maybe extending something that should have been there, and also keeping in mind that when that went into effect, it was before Senate Bill 1145 with the community corrections. Community corrections, for those members who've been here as long as I have in 1995, is when we actually went into partnership with the counties and said, if you take felons who have a sentence of 12 months or less into your facility, we would provide certain funding. And so where many of these individuals used to be in the state system, they are now in the county system. Is it the best thing to do? Well, that's a philosophy discussion, but we felt that this was one area that needed to be addressed. Regarding your inquiry regarding what other states are doing, I can tell you that, as Mr. O'Leary said, we are more on a lax permissive, because we allow individuals on the day that they are released from custody to retain certain rights that other states do not. Many states prohibit felons from voting for years after they have been incarcerated until sometime in the future. Our state does not do that, and so we're not trying to, in fact, we're just trying to mirror what is being applied to felons who are within the state system, for those same felons who just by chance get a sentence that put them into the county facility.
Thank you for offering that. Very good. Any further discussion on the bill? I would then entertain a motion on the amendment. Representative Shields.
Madam Chair, I move the -A5 amendment into House Bill 3638.
Representative Shields moves the -A5 amendment into House Bill 3638. Discussion on that motion to amend? Any objections? Seeing none, motion to amend carries. I would now entertain a motion, Senator Schrader.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3638 as amended to forward the U.S. recommendation.
Senator Schrader moves House Bill 3638A as amended to the floors with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Any objections? Senator Gordon objects.
The 200 beds is my issue.
And Senator Carter objects. Motion carries. Senator Prezonsky will carry on the Senate floor, and Representatives McPherson and Olson will co-carry on the House floor. Gentlemen, thank you for your attention and your patience with us as we walk through this, and all of your hard work over the last several months. And colleagues, thank you for a very good discussion on those two bills. They're very complex, and I appreciate the way we approach them. And now into close that work session. Open work session on Senate Bill 5556. Well, hello, Mr. Siebert. We're going to look at the Department of Agriculture.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Agriculture is here requesting some permission to apply to the U.S. Department of Agriculture for a $210,261 grant, an increase in federal funds expenditure limitation of like amount to enhance the state's participation in the National Animal Identification Service. On July 11th of this year, the department was informed of the opportunity to receive federal funds by the USDA to enhance the state's ability to trace animal identification through improvements to the National Animal Identification Service. And ODA proposes to use this money to purchase some handheld electronic devices for their brand inspecting folks to input information in the field. This should enhance the department's ability to trace animal diseases and should also result in some efficiencies within the program, which I would note is all directly fee funded. There's a general fund in the brand inspection program. The department's 0709 legislatively approved budget has only a little less than $350,000 of total federal funds expenditure limitation for this division and other divisions that are in the program yet, so they need an increase in their federal funds expenditure limitation.
Okay, so the motion would be to amend the bill when we take it up to include that limitation.
Anybody want to query on this bill?
May I make a motion?
Yes, ma'am. Representative Morgan.
I move the LFO recommendation to the Department of Agriculture grant.
Representative Morgan moves the LFO recommendation. Discussion on that motion?
Madam Chair? If I might just clarify that part of the motion is that the increased expenditure limitation be unscheduled until the department receives the money, and that will be reflected in the budget report.
I'm sure that's what you intended.
That's right.
Yes.
The recommendation.
It was. Representative Jensen. Okay. Any objections? Seeing none. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Koba, thank you. Excellent presentation. Very persuasive. Department of Administrative Services. Hello, Mr. Whalen.
Madam Co-Chair. The first of the Department of Administrative Services is a request that the committee include adjustments to 74 state agency budgets in Senate Bill 5556 because of state changes in the state data center rate structure. The budgets of all these state agencies, when they were adopted, essentially had assessments for the data center. Subsequent to that, the federal government came in and said, no, that's not allowed for purposes of federal reimbursement. You have to develop a more of a rate-based, usage-based rate structure. That has been done, causing some changes then to 74 state agency budgets. The Department of Administrative Services committed to the Data Center Governing Board that it would come forward with a request for adjustments to those budgets, and they are here with that request. And the LFO recommendation is to defer action for a number of reasons. This request would require some additional general fund to some agencies, reductions in general fund to other agencies, increased lottery funds to some agencies, reductions and increases in other federal funds. We believe it's a little premature to deal with this, and the amounts could be dealt with later by the emergency board.
Madam Co-Chair, I would move the LFO recommendation to the Department of Administrative Services request for adjustment.
Okay. Representative Morgan moves the LFO recommendation, which is to defer this decision pending further developments. Senator Berger?
I'd pass, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay.
Any other discussion?
Any objections? Okay, we'll take that. Motion two. And the stalwarts are still here. We're still under work session.
Yes, the next item on your agenda, Madam Chair, is a statutorily required report on internal audit activities. As you know, the legislature in 2005 set a framework for internal audit activities, and the Department of Administrative Services by law is required to provide an annual report on those activities. If it's done so, you have received that report and the LFO recommendation that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you.
Madam Commissioner,
yes.
I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. That moves acknowledging receipt of the report. I can barely get out. I'm so in your style. Any objections? Seeing none. Okay, we'll close that work session. Informational meeting. We want to bring them up now.
I believe so.
Chief Ms. Kautz has been waiting patiently to, and I don't think it was just because she wanted to be informed about. Yes, thank you, Senate Bill 1087. Although I bet you learned something as we did.
Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Kautz. I'm the interim director of the Department of Administrative Services. With me this evening, I have Scott Hara, who is the interim deputy director right now for the Department of Administrative Services, and Tamara Brickman from Budget Management Division. We have three informational reports for you this evening, one on the State Data Center, one regarding Capitol Mall construction and planning that we put forward, and then the third one, the flood, 2007 flood. At this point, I have asked everyone to keep a very brief high-level overview. We have given you materials for backup and information. We will do some quick presentations for you, answer any questions, and in the interest of time, we can go into detail or scale back as you wish.
I think you are astute to observe that the brief introductory comments would suffice, and we will point you in the direction of anything we need more detail on.
You bet.
Thank you.
At this time, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. You should have in your packet a presentation on state data center awareness of the time. I will try to summarize very quickly for you and not walk you through all the materials, and if you have specific questions, I'll be happy to answer them. And for the record, again, my name is Scott Hara. I'm the Interim Deputy Director for the Department of Administrative Services, and when I'm not playing this role, I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Last January, the department submitted to the Interim Ways and Means Committee an emergency board letter on two issues. One of them had to do with energy constraints at the state data center, and the other one had to do with replacement of the email hub. Before the meeting, the director and I decided to withdraw that letter and to look at alternative approaches to dealing with those problems. I formed a work group with the state CIOs to look at the energy issue. And in summary, we have come up with a strategy that will help mitigate the energy consumption needs at the state data center by moving two components of the state data center out. One of them is the Medicaid Management Information System, which is actually managed by EDS, and move that to another state facility, and then to temporarily move the Department of Consumer and Business Services 200 servers back to the Labor and Industries building until the server consolidation can be completed, and then remigrate those applications back to the state data center. Not their equipment, but just the applications. That buys us at least 5 years of energy growth at the state data center, and we feel that this is a workable plan for both the state data center and their customers. The other issue that has come up is the very outdated email hub that the state has. It was originally designed to handle 500,000 emails a day. Currently, we see over 6 million emails go through that hub. Over 90% of that is spam, and a lot of that spam contains malicious information and malware viruses and that type of thing. And the appliances that we have in place currently are barely keeping up with the demands. And so what we've also done is with the same CIO group, we are looking at the capital budget of the state data center and of the security office in the enterprise information division, and to see reprioritize our capital expenditures and to make that purchase out of the existing budget in the current biennium. So there's going to be some reprioritization. We have not completed that work, but we hope to have that done within the next 30 days.
Thank you.
And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Carter, yes?
I'm trying to understand, in our projections of the state data center being a better fit, less costly air, and everything else, and now to move 200 people out in order to save an energy, just explain that a little more for me.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Carter, we're moving 200 servers out, not 200 people.
Oh, okay.
And what we're kind of faced with here is a bit of a energy bubble as we migrate off of older equipment onto the newer equipment.
I'm there. I misunderstood.
Okay. Any other questions? Good clarification. Co-Chair
Sherry? I just wanted to commend the department for working with us on this and realizing our budget shortfall and trying to really think this through this creatively using some new opportunities there. And hopefully we'll get things going in 2009-11 and be able to build towards long-term solutions, especially with the energy issue that you're dealing with. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ditto.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I just had one quick question. It appears that you're going to be able to buy this new email hub out of your own existing budget, which is commendable. I wonder what services might be reduced by that $1.25 million, or will that be charged out to another agency?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsett, that process is still under review, but basically the State Data Center has about $5 million remaining in its capital budget for the current biennium, And what we'd be looking at is to reprioritize those capital expenditures and deferring some of those expenditures into the next biennium.
Anything else on that item? Okay, Ms. Couts, next one.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Chris Couts, interim director for the Department of Administrative Services. With me this evening, I have Abby Kershaw from the Office of Emergency Management. We are here to do a very quick tag team discussion of the 2007 December storms and what potential impact those may have on state agencies, and a request that we are anticipating probably the Department of Administrative Services bringing forward on behalf of state agencies to the June emergency board for funding for those portions that don't appear FEMA will reimburse. So with that, I'm going to have Abby talk a little bit about the process and where we're at, and then we'll talk a little bit about the numbers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. As Chris indicated, I'm Abby Kershaw. I'm a section director with Oregon Emergency Management, and I'm currently serving as the state coordinating officer and administering the FEMA assistance. I apologize. One of the handouts did not make it into your packet, and it's a summary, and I will make sure that the committee gets it. It's our recovery assistance to date. It's dollars and statistics. All of the deadlines for individuals and public entities to apply for the FEMA assistance has passed. February 7th was the last day. On their individual side, we had 3,561 families that registered for assistance. When you consider that's maybe three or four people in a family, well over 10,000 people served by FEMA in this disaster. We administered a little over $5.8 million in grants. That is primarily housing grants, housing assistance to individuals. There were nine counties declared, six of them for individual assistance. The majority of the individual assistance claims came from Clatsop County and, of course, the greater Nehalem area in Columbia County. Small Business Administration is a very big part of the disaster programs. They've, to date, made loans over $9 million to 610 loan applications, primarily to individuals and businesses. And finally, on the public entity side, we have taken requests for public assistance from 158 eligible entities. This is significantly more than we anticipated. Our preliminary damage estimates are about $54 million in public assistance, which is public infrastructure assistance, estimating about 750 project worksheets. We are, if you look at your handout on the individual assistance sequence of delivery, what I've just given you is something that kind of shows the process that people go through when they register with FEMA, the types of assistance that FEMA provides. The second page, I've given you a snapshot of the public assistance process, and where we are right now is basically the third line in formulation of projects, project reviews, and approvals. We hope to get all of these projects into the system by the end of March. By that time, we'll have a very good idea of what the FEMA dollars are going to pay for. OEM acts as the grantee for that funding, and then we pass it through to the local governments and special districts. On page three, basically what Chris asked me to do is based on the public entities that we're dealing with, local governments, kind of get an idea of anybody that may be having trouble meeting their cost share. The public assistance provides grants. They're 75-25, with the local applicant paying for the 25% cost share. We've tried to kind of get an idea based on our project officers working out in the field, some of those local jurisdictions that have said we're going to have a tough time meeting the 25% cost share. No surprise here, the biggest one is the Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad. We just wrote a $1.2 million project worksheet to the port today. That is the first step in just doing an engineering and environmental assessment. Whatever way the railroad goes, we want to get to what are their true eligible costs. And then once that's determined, people can decide what they want to do about that, an alternate project, repair it, whatever. And the thing I want to point out on that $7.9 million is it doesn't include the 69 special districts. And part of that is these are the very tiny special districts oftentimes that really significantly are impacted like this, the little water districts, sewer districts that ultimately have to turn to their ratepayers to see some of their costs reimbursed. And we just didn't have a way of gathering those costs. We will know more, though, again, as I indicated, when we get through the project formulation and get those projects obligated. And with that, I'll let Chris talk about the state agency costs.
Right. So the last page in this series of handouts is where we're at today with the state agencies that we anticipate will be submitting requests for public assistance to FEMA. If you look at the third column over, it looks like total costs incurred are about $18.6 million. The expected FEMA reimbursement is about $6.3 million. I'm going to move to the last numbers column where you see the $9.4 million. The biggest component there is other, where risk management may be picking up some costs for some of the damage done to state agencies. The biggest component there you see, though, is that the Federal Highway Administration has a special program for ODOT for some of these types of things, and they won't be using FEMA, but will be using other federal assistance that's available. So what you come back to is that third number column there, which says about, at this point in time, with the best information we have, and it's not complete, like I said, plan to be back in June with the more complete data, is about $2.8 million impact for state government of those costs that won't be reimbursed by FEMA in this process. That was really the bottom line that we wanted to get to today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Gorsuch.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair, and appreciating that you are going to be coming back with additional information. The cost incurred by public health in the Department of Human Services and also addictions and mental health appear very low. Can you say more about what's calculated here, especially around public health?
Co-Chair Senator Gordley, basically what public health was eligible for, it's their emergency protective measures when they stood up their agency operations center in response to the flood. This is primarily the overtime costs for their employees that worked with the communities out in the field. It's emergency protective measures. Responding. Also on the mental health piece, they applied for a FEMA crisis counseling grant, a $61,000, 100% federal funds that they did use in the first 2 months to help clientele in Tillamook County. So those are pretty much their costs in overtime for their staff to work on this event.
I see.
Okay. Thanks. Anybody else? Senator Boucher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to lift up to the committee that while this was a very terrible disaster to the people that it impacted, if you look at a natural disaster that's possible in Oregon, you can multiply these figures many times.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a gap in our legislation because we were unable to get it through, as Senator Carter remembers, and we have a situation and a major disaster that we would not be able to spend money. There is no authority for us to have an unbalanced budget. And I think at some point in time, those good minds on this committee need to be looking at that, because that could be a very serious impediment in case of that kind of disaster.
Thank you. You may enlist your services, Senator. Anything else on that report? Ms. Scouts.
Thank you very much. That concludes that. And I, unless there's any additional questions, we'll move to the next one. So, thank you, Abby. For the next item, Robin Harpster from the Facilities Division will be joining me for the record, members, Chris Kautz, Interim Director from the Department of Administrative Services. We are here to do a presentation on the Capitol Mall space needs and feasibility study that we did in accordance with monies that were allocated during the 2007-2009 biennium to take a look at the Capitol Mall, and with that, I'm going to turn it over quickly to Robin to talk about the process and where we're at.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Robin Harpster, the Facilities Administrator for DAS, and I will provide you with a brief report of our feasibility study of the Capitol Mall space needs and growth plan for the Capitol Mall. In 2007, DAS submitted and the legislature approved a planning request to investigate the consolidation or expansion of state agency offices and associated parking into new or existing buildings on the Capitol Mall. Two primary issues led to this request. First, we found that state facilities on the Capitol Mall are overcrowded and inefficiently utilized. Agencies are currently located at multiple locations, and spaces are near maximum densities. Also, the recent renovation projects of the state Capitol building have led to officials and staff being displaced on the Capitol Mall area. Secondly, existing parking capacity on the Capitol Mall is also inefficient. The former Capitol Planning Commission mandated a ratio of one parking space for two employees for state workers in state facilities, preferably in off-street locations. Currently, 4,500 parking spaces are available, but we have 550 to 600 individuals on the waiting list right now for parking spaces on the Capitol Mall. Development of new sites has the potential to significantly increase parking capacity, while at the same time will enable more effective use of alternative transportation modes. Our first investigation was to undertake an internal review of our leases. We reviewed existing leases on the Capitol Mall to get a better understanding of what agencies needed and their future growth plans. Next, there were several sites we were considering for expansion. Those sites included the red lot, the yellow lot, and the green lot. Due to some inefficiencies as well with the executive building block, we looked at the executive building as a location as well for a possible new development. To go into a little bit of detail about our process, no?
We don't need a lot of detail about the process. I think if anyone wants detail, we'll ask you questions.
Okay.
We understand you've got very good processes set up.
Okay. Keep going. Okay, just to summate what we have found through the space study, we have found that the most effective use of our future land will be on the red lot and yellow lot for a parking lot and building, as well as the yellow lot. There are 9 agencies that we've identified that could be probable candidates for the future construction, and so obviously we'll look at several factors in determining who would be most appropriate for those locations. There's more details in your packets about those two sites and the specifics of how we can maximize our building construction, and with that I'll be happy to answer any other questions about our process.
Thanks, and I appreciate that, and I'm sure that this is another item that we will discuss over the next several months with the department. Questions on this report?
Senator Johnson?
I guess the only thing I'd like to ask is, you've identified them as possible candidates. Have they identified themselves? I mean, the reason that I'm asking is that it seems as though we've made assumptions about what people or agencies are willing or not willing to do. And I go back to the renovation of this building when the eviction notices were just sort of slipped under the door of the constitutional officers. And I'd like to know that this isn't something that a process committee has decided somewhere with a... I'm trying to gauge how much the agencies have said, yeah, we'd love to move, and these are our space requirements, and this is what we think we need.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, that's part of the process that we undertook. There was actually a pretty encompassing stakeholders group that involved all the agencies, where we did data collecting and surveying of their existing needs as well as future needs into the year 2020 to gauge exactly what their needs would be as we looked at these two lots. Okay. Senator Schrader.
Just a quick question. What about the parking issue? Where are people going to park?
I'm sorry, Chair. No, I'm not.
Well, I mean, we're placing the parking lots, right? So, it's
underground parking.
Is that the
legislators get less passes?
Chair, Senator Schrader, to answer your question, yes, we have considered also the parking is in part of this effort. So we have technology that we're looking at to increase the density of parking that we can look at, as well as to maximize the parking that we can accommodate on these two lots.
It's a fabulous invention that we've discovered in downtown Portland. You can actually build multiple levels of parking underneath the building. It's fascinating. I'd be happy to give you a tour.
I've gotten lost down there.
Senator Woodson, did you want to join our tour?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. And
yeah,
a question?
I also ask a question. In your options, have you considered the option of leasing the land to private enterprise to have them build a parking garage or a office building with a parking garage? And have you compared that against the state costs and so forth?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, to answer your question, we have not gone into that level of detail yet. At this point, we have reviewed private lease costs versus the cost of public rent rates, but we have not gone into that level of detail in terms of leasing out the construction and ultimately them managing it. No, not at this time, but we can.
Thank you.
Good
idea.
Good as well. Senator Johnson.
Are you tailoring current lease agreements to fit in with your planning so that you're not, in today's date, executing 20-year lease agreements with other landlords? I mean, I know ODOT has little pockets of ODOT scattered around, and I don't know how long those leases are for.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, may I answer your question? Right now, we have a laundry list of those leases and when they're going to expire, and those are the agencies that we're considering as viable candidates for these two lots.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Excellent.
You have all been very patient with us.
Thank you. Anything else, Madam Chair, members?
I don't think so.
Pleasure to be here today. Thank you very much.
Members, and I will take it upon myself to inform the once again truant House members that tomorrow we are intending to bring all four committee-originated bills forward and walk through proposed amendments to those bills. So it will be a roll-up-your-sleeves kind of work session. And it would be our expectation that we would then move those bills on Thursday. Mr. Co-Chair, is there anything else you'd like to say about the plans for tomorrow? In that case, we're adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.